Welcome to another segment of Ecosystem TV. I'm going to have a very fascinating discussion today that brings together design, the built environment, cities, governments, and of course, all centered around the theme of sustainability. And it's my pleasure today to welcome a leader who's actually been very, very involved in this way before it became mainstream. So Chintan Ravesia, who's an architect himself, has been a big proponent of sustainable cities and actually leads the Southeast Asia practice for Arup, which is one of the world's leading design and sustainability focused firms with a very strong presence in Asia Pacific. Chintan also heads the Center for Climate Action in Cities for Arup, and that's a think tank that actually leads some of the efforts to create much more sustainable cities for us. So welcome, Chintan. Really pleased to have you.
Thanks, Amit. It's an absolute pleasure to come here as well, and thanks for the invite.
Oh, my pleasure. And look, we have had you on sessions before. I've heard you speak, and you know, we've had a lot of conversations in the past around some of the things that you do and things that we take for granted around the built environment that's built around us and how much thought process and planning actually goes into it. And it's quite a marvel when you think about it. You know, when we plan, like in our world, Chintan, when we plan product development and stuff, we're thinking of sprints, like the next 6 months, the next 2 weeks, literally. You're building plans that will shape, possibly in some instances, through your own lifetime. That needs a lot of patience for, you know, to wait for them to kind of come to fruition. So it does require quite a strong vision and commitment towards achieving that. So I'm actually really fascinated. And I'd love to know more about Arup, just for our audience, in terms of what it is that you guys do and what sets you apart.
Arup is a built environment firm. So we are a group of planners, designers, engineers, economists, architects who work together to achieve one clear objective, which is developing a truly sustainable built environment. We are more than 70 to 80 years old. We started in London, and now we are around more than 19,000 people across the world. In my role here as a city's lead for Arup's business in Southeast Asia, we do everything from developing city strategies for governments to think about their future overall. So we're currently helping Singapore for their energy strategy, for example, to planning big cities, future cities, new cities, or even retrofitting existing cities, to design and engineering the next generation net zero buildings. For example, we are working on the new Changi Terminal T5 right now. And thinking about it, of course, and as you pointed out, the next 5-10 years, the buildings have to be climate positive, if not net zero. And how do you achieve that? So that's our day-to-day job of thinking about how do we think about a future if it needs to be net zero or more so climate positive.
Lots of stakeholders you have to work with in this regard, because if you're just doing a building, I would imagine you still have there's a lot that goes into it. And there's a set of stakeholders that come in. How does that process work? Where does it even start and where does it end in terms of the plans getting the go ahead?
That's interesting. Especially when you're thinking about these massive, huge developments, and we'll probably speak about that later. But when you're planning something where, let's say a new city, where someone's going to move in, a family's going to move in, not even 5, probably 7, 8, 10 years from now. So we're talking about in 2030s. Like you think about your plans as 2 weeks, four weeks for that matter, 6 weeks. We need to think about what is going to excite you to move to a brand new place 10 years from now. And that requires, of course, future thinking, a future gazing. But at the same time, we got to think about how flexible can we plan our things so that 10 years from now, things need to change, it can change seamlessly. And of course, you have the usual stakeholders, which is you need to have the governments to with you. You need to have the financiers or funders of these big developments on your side. You need to have all agencies, how are you going to manage waste, water, energy, et cetera, all of those coming together. Believe it or not, the most important stakeholder in all, there are two most important stakeholders in all these conversations. One is the people you want to attract and retain them in the new city. So the residents, they become the biggest stakeholders for the future. and of the future, you have to remember that, because the stakeholder you're talking to are probably not the ones who are going to move there. Probably the kids are going to move there.
That's right.
And the other one is literally, I say the topmost stakeholder in any of my conversations actually is nature. Nature has to be an absolute stakeholder in every conversation in terms of anything that we do. How does it work with the biodiversity, the flora, the fauna, the birds, the animals are in that place, and how do you work with that or them to get a better future? So it's literally getting all of those ducks in the row, and most of the times they're never in the row, and you change how the ducks move one after the other as you go through the process.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. I mean, there's I would imagine a lot of research that goes into this process to actually understand every aspect of that ecosystem, the biodiversity, the financial ecosystem, what's going to be driving commercial interests for people to be there, the commutes for people, what's the office landscape going to look like. So as you do that, do you guys do a lot of that research yourself?
Yeah, in most cases, a good portion of the research is done by us, but we never shy away from having the best minds and best partners along with us on the journey to look at things. And no one should be saying it, and we definitely don't say that we have the brains for everything under the sun to make a best city in the world. So I think we connect a lot with people who are already in the thing. You spoke earlier before we got on this call about people who are engaged with the civic society. We sometimes work with them, so the social agencies for that matter, connect a lot with them to build thought, thinking, research, what the likes and desires are, work with real estate agencies, exactly what you talked about, in terms of what will attract a developer to come to a brand new city, to put in that money and take the risk, especially I would say the phase one of a city. And when there's nothing there and you have the first 100 buildings coming in there, who are the ones who are going to put in the money there, and how much is the government going to invest in there so that the developers think I think this is going to be a success? Those are the right people we get on board with.
I actually want to jump into sort of, to me, one of the most fascinating projects that I'm seeing in Asia, or actually for that matter, anywhere, is the development of the new capital city. When you started your career, you went to architecture school. Did you actually think that, hey, one day I'm going to be involved in actually shaping the capital of one of the largest countries of the world?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Yes, I did do my architecture first, and I very quickly realized by the time I finished architecture that I actually did not like designing buildings. I actually liked designing urban areas. So that's when I decided to go and do my urban design. By the time I got to London, and then I joined Arup in London, actually, because Arup was the first one to start thinking about, and you mentioned that when it was not mainstream, was designing eco-cities in China when no one was talking about eco-cities in early 2000s. And I was like, where could I do these big things? So then I moved to London, and I started going to Shanghai and China back and forth in 2006 to think about how do we even think about it. I didn't know that you had to think about all these other cogs in the wheels that had come together to make a city. So that's those long journeys and moving across the world, eventually coming here to Singapore in 2015, still not knowing that 3 or 4 years later, I'll get the opportunity to lead the plan for the third most populous country in the world's new capital city in the 21st century. So yes, it has been an amazing journey.
Yeah, tell us a bit more about that experience. It's really the one that will actually impact, I guess, for us living in Southeast Asia, probably the biggest initiative that we're going to see from a planning perspective.
2018 it was. So you have to realize it is pre-COVID. Yeah, the world was a very, very different place then. It's when we got on to developing the plan for Indonesia's new capital city, which is 256,000 hectares. And if you think about it in terms of size, it's probably five times the size of Singapore. And we had to start thinking about a blank piece of paper almost. Of course, not so blank, because you have a lot of flora, fauna, again, a lot of nature there. There are existing population there in certain areas where it sits. There is a lot of biodiversity that exists there. So that was our blank piece of paper, so to start with. Think about what that future should be. I think probably the most interesting and equally challenging part of that was having 100 plus ministerial people in one room, and we literally went through a workshop process, think about what are the goods and the bads in the world in terms of examples of what we should not do and what we should do. As simple as highways, 6-lane highways for a city, bad thing. Cycle lanes with green areas, good thing. We literally went through that process to kind of work with people's behaviors and thinking in terms of what we want to expect. So the first 2 months, we literally did not put any pen on paper. And as an urban designer, that was like a big thing to not start designing. No, we did not. We actually ran vision and objectives workshops to everyone to be aligned on the same vision and objectives to finally say, okay, now we'll put pen on paper to say that anything and everything that we do should connect to the objectives and visions that we all agreed on the top there and eventually develop. And we actually now have a book of, I think, 2,000, close to 2,000 KPIs to achieve that net zero city, which has gone into an application and done and dusted. So if anyone, a developer, goes and builds something in 2035, they need to adhere to those KPIs. That's been the journey. And then, of course, COVID hit in the middle, and then we still were working on the plans, and 2021, we finally finished that work, and now we're still continuing to work, but from a very different angle.
And when do you anticipate, if you're able to talk about it, that you actually see that city start to shape up and people start to move in?
Well, we are not party to the implementation of the city.
Sure.
I think that's in the hands of the government agencies that are taking care of it. But from what I hear, and we actually we were just talking about it, that there was Equisparity event happening in Singapore this week, and the President Jokowi was actually here in Singapore, and he presented the whole scheme and spoke about how they are going to have close to 200,000 people moving in the next 2 years there. So that's the start of the first phase. So there you go.
That is amazing. I mean, that requires some pretty heavy lift. What do you think are the motivations for governments to take these steps? Because, you know, this is obviously a great way to be a flag bearer for a nation to move towards sustainable living for, you know, not just from a biodiversity standpoint, but also giving their own population a better environment to be in and be part of that biodiversity. So what are the motivations, you think, for stakeholders to make these big, bold, progressive decisions?
Some of them are quite practical. I completely support the idea that Indonesia needed to move its capital from Jakarta. Jakarta needs space to breathe and breathe as a financial capital. I think there's just too much load on it. And plus, we all know that Jakarta is thinking and all the other issues around climate that's causing it. So the move, I completely get it in terms of pure practicality, completely supportive of that. But also, as you said, I think, and I've always mentioned that to the ministers, and everyone's agreed to that, is that we have to realize that we're building, this is probably the first capital city to be built in the 21st century in the climate emergency era. And probably others have heard me say this before, that it has to live, breathe, behave, operate, experience different than any of the other cities we've ever lived till date in our lives. Because everything that you're experiencing right now is what was thought about in 20th century. Nothing that we know right now should be drawn and designed, and the buildings that you see behind your screen should be like that. We cannot, because we cannot afford to be even be net zero. Our future needs to be regenerative and climate positive for us to mend what we have screwed up the world right now as we speak. So that is the premise that we started with, and that is the premise that the government has, that you have the way to look at, you are the first one to think about this in this century, in this era, and your city has to be almost like a trademark for any other city that comes in the world in the future to say, this is how a future living should be.
From a lifestyle perspective for people who actually go into these cities or smart cities, as this capital will be, what will change for them from a lifestyle perspective? And what do you think? I love the way you articulated those 5 points around, and you ended with experience. And what would that experience be for these inhabitants, and how would that be different?
It's a good point you raised there, and I was very conscious when I said experience. Over the course of time, I've had various debates on this conversation about who moves to a brand new city. Like in Singapore, we have new towns where people move in a new town. as one premise that we always think about cities, what keeps me in a city? What kept me in London? What keeps me in Singapore? What keeps me in other cities that I've lived in? A good portion of that is memories in a city. Memories create a sense of ownership of the city, and then the memories get translated to other people's memories, and it just builds up. And it creates that aura around that citizenry and the citizenship of a city. Those things do not exist in a brand new city. You got to create memories from scratch. And that's where one thing is attracting people to a new city, which would be probably easy, because if you think about in Indonesia, and if anyone's ever been to Indonesia, to have a city, this is the first city that the Indonesian government is planning from scratch. Normally, people have moved into areas, and then the planning authority goes in and draws a line around and says, okay, that's a new urban development. The first time they're planning something, and they're planning with that rigor, at least I hope we get that in terms of the implementation, a city which is going to be a 10-minute walking city, where it's going to be green, where you're not going to think about cars around you. Your kid will be able to walk very, very safely to a bus station and take a train and go somewhere where they want. Those are the things people aspire to as a basic. We think of it, we take it granted in Singapore, that aspect. Yeah. And other cities want to aspire to that even better than what we get in Singapore for that matter. So I have a feeling that attracting people to that basic tenets of livability aspect should not be an issue.
So Chintan, one of the things that I've picked here through our conversation is obviously there are a lot of factors being considered. Like, there are things that you've talked about, elements of whether it's the biodiversity, whether it's the people, whether it's the demographics, and so many other factors that have gone into all the planning that you would do and the stakeholders would do. How do you actually process all that information? Because that's a lot of information. It can't just be sitting in your head.
There are a lot of people behind this. A team of close to 100 people, but in terms of geologists, engineers, structural engineers, to economists, to social scientists, all of those. And we actually, for example, when we are thinking about the new capital city, which is, as I said, 256,000 hectares, every hectare down to 1 square kilometer had enough data to say this is a land of so-and-so, the soil is so-and-so, that's how steep it is. That's where how many people live in that area and all of that. That's where the animal movements happen. That's where the bats are. And that's where all of those things were absolutely put in one thing for us to actually have those 20 to 25 indicators in place to be able to decide this is where we're going to touch nature. This is where we're going to touch the soil. This is where the buildings are going to be. Yeah. All of those conversations have been through because there was absolutely backed with data, every decision making.
I wanted to get a sense from you, like, are there other cities that are looked at and seen as the template to consider when nations or governments are thinking about adapting new ways of either reshaping their cities or building new cities?
I would not say there is one city that's perfect. So when we are thinking about cities, we always think about aspects within the city or projects in the city that have really, really worked well. And that learning can come from any city in the world, to be honest. Singapore's done a fantastic job in digitization. And I think that digital thing, and we'll talk a bit about that later, but I think especially post-COVID, they've really managed to change that in terms of accessibility and data and connectivity of people. And there's something that other cities should learn. And I know Singapore is a special case because it's a city state, and it's difficult when other cities in a state have to think about how to do that. But it's something still to admire. The best example I could think about is Medellin in Colombia. The very simple fact that Medellin actually is in a valley, and you have the less well-off on the top, and the more well off you are, you're actually closer to the valley down there, and that's where the most industries and everything of work is. I think what the mayor did a fantastic job was literally getting cable cars connecting the top to the bottom, basically connecting jobs and opportunities to people. That right. just transformed the crime rates in the city. The mayor spent huge amount of money building public, beautiful public library buildings, And believe it or not, the crime rate around the public libraries and the precinct has gone down. People never put any graffiti on the building because people are proud of those public infrastructure. And the pride is important when you want your city to be considered as a city, a successful city.
You know, I had an opportunity to, I was part of a session where I spoke, run by JTC, and it was really around PDD, the Punggol Digital District. And it was quite amazing that we actually have something like that coming up in Singapore, where one, it's a multi-use development, but then they've actually thought about everything, and everything is connected, and everything is ubiquitous. So for a citizen, they've actually looked at it from the city element. That's where I wanted to touch on the technology piece, where they've actually changed the entire architecture of how all of these various multi-agencies, utility providers all come together through, you know, through an architecture that's kind of unified and that gives one experience to the citizens. How easy or difficult do you think that is? Is that more of a technology play, or is that a result of all the things that you described that actually go into building a great city or a development?
I think it's a great example of the success of thinking about what the future needs or what the future population needs for the enhancement. Probably this is where I should talk about, we all love these things, 6Cs, 3Ds, 4Ds, 7Ds, whatever. But I really believe in the 3Ds, which I'm going to touch on, which is whenever I'm thinking about a future of any of our cities, I think about three things, which is decarbonization, digitization, and disclosure. And I'll touch on disclosure, which probably is the most important D for me right now. But we just cannot get away from not thinking about our cities in terms of where the digital and the physical come together in terms of operating in any possible way. People need that for our day-to-day needs, but more so every bit of infrastructure needs that. And the reason why digital is really good is, coming back to a sustainability conversation, is where the disclosure part comes. When I say disclosure, what I mean is, we really do not know how much carbon we use in our lives. We really do not know the table that I'm sitting in or the computer that I have in me, how much carbon is going to make that computer for me and which I'm using right now. If I are able to measure every bit of that, disclose that measurement, then we really truly can think about what the baseline is with which we can go move forward. So the more we have such kind of developments where things are digitally measured in every possible thing that we do. So beyond just the lifestyle charges of providing people the basic sense of internet that we can do these kind of calls and work, but also how much is the light being used, how much is the energy being generated, how much of the energy is being used, it will only help us to think really about our personal carbon footprints, but also as a society, but also as a planet.
Even from a commercial standpoint or a, you know, just from a business lens, given that the generation that's coming in are now much more aware of, you know, the values that we're seeking as a society, and, you know, there's a lot more information available to them, do you not think that, given that these this entire set of talent and consumers are going to be coming in into the workforce and into the economy in the next 10 to 15 years, that everyone should be thinking about getting this right?
Absolutely. And that's why I think that it gives me an absolute push when I listen to the next generation, because as we were talking about earlier, that the cities where we are designing is for that, is for those users. The users are going to be very, very different.
Yeah.
And this is what we tell. So one thing is designing a capital city for a government because they have a very clear government mandate. Southeast Asia is unique because we have huge developments that are built in this part of the world by private developers. And we have to work with the private developers in thinking about those aspects as well, the beyond profit, the people you want to attract to the cities are either the companies who are not going to move to your new development if it's not net zero or reaching to net zero, or the next generation is not going to buy a family home into your building out there, is because they are way more conscious than any of us of where they're going to live, how are they going to live and what they're going to wear and where are their clothes coming from. And if we cannot touch those lines right now, then 6 or 7 years from now, we won't be successful. So we absolutely got to be conscious of those future subscribers who are currently already subscribers to a lot of other things in life. And we've got to learn from them.
You know how when you build a really nice, fancy building, people always leave a mark somewhere. What did you leave on the city? Have you put a mark there that you go back and you say, oh, I'm going to come back and see this? And have you ever considered that? If you haven't, maybe it's not too late.
Well, believe it or not, there are a lot of discussions that we have when we're planning or designing our cities. And there are always few things that you think like, let's try this. Let's put that small, an example, a small people's park in that area. And we'd love to see in 10 years from now if people are going to use it the way that we thought they would use it. And it'll be even more surprising that in 10 years from now, people use it completely differently than what we thought they would use it, because we actually don't even know how 10 years from now people are going to use public spaces. And those are the only ways we can actually think about how our marks would be that, oh, yeah, that street that I designed as a pedestrian street is superly working well because we decided to put that one small nursery there. And that just seamlessly worked with families and parents coming together.
I'm actually really glad that we've had this discussion. You know, the role of technology in shaping these cities and shaping urban infrastructure and built environment is so critical, but I think you just put so many different layers on it today that gives us a better understanding of what all goes into it. The technology is just the connector, but eventually it's all about the people that are going to live there. So really appreciate it. There'll be a set of people who will not have the ability to move, right? The aging population, for example. Do you feel like that gets addressed in the planning? And do you think that there will be an opportunity to make it inclusive?
I actually think that aging population will move, because I think that the people who are working in Asia has a lot of the still holds the thing about families living together, like grandparents, kids,
yep.
People working. And we think that if those 200,000 odd people who, as the president said, are going to move in the next 2 years, they are going to move with their families, which includes parents, grandparents, and kids growing together. All statistics say that when people are in cleaner air and in much more shaded, the heat island effect is reduced. The temperatures don't go warp up too much, which is how we design our cities. Living in nature, having more green around you, you hear the sound of birds and the sound of cars, improve the quality of your life as you age, because these things affect you more. This may become a place where actually people want to grow old already, not the next generation. So that would be a pure success if actually people of all generations think, all ages think that that's a place where I want to grow old, or that's a place I want to create my memories as I grow old.
I would love to understand in another conversation, and I hope we have that soon, on how a firm like yours actually uses the data to actually bring it all together. I think that is where the future is. You know, we're going to be getting into not just a digital economy, but it's actually a data economy, because that's what's going to power the entire economy going forward. So I think it'll be interesting to see how all of these pieces come together. So I'd love to invite you again and have a more deeper conversation around that. So hope to have that soon as well.
Yeah, look forward to it. Thanks a lot.